Hello and welcome to the Crisis Point podcast. I'm Eric Sammons, the editor-in-chief of Crisis Magazine. Here at Crisis Point, we interview the leading Catholics of today about the crisis going on in the church and the culture. If you have not already, please subscribe to this channel on your favorite platform, be it YouTube or your podcast network or whatever the case may be. Today, we're very honored to have a great guest, and that is Austin Ruse. He is the president of CFAM, a New York and Washington, D.C.-based research institute in special consultative status with the U.N. Economic and Social Council, which he will explain because I don't understand what that means. He is also a contributing editor to Crisis Magazine. He writes tons of columns and books. His next book, which will be out next month, I believe, from Crisis Publications, is Under Siege, No Finer Time to Be a Faithful Catholic. Thanks for coming on, Austin. It's great to have you here.
I'm delighted to be here. I'm delighted to write for Crisis. I was one of the founding columnists at the Catholic thing, and I don't know how it happened. Either John Vella reached out to me or I reached out to John Vella, and I started writing for both. So I was doing a weekly column, switching back and forth. That became a little bit too much. And so I decided that I wanted to continue with Crisis. You know, Crisis is a venerable publication, you know, going back to Dinesh D'Souza and Michael Novak back in the day. And it was always a priority of mine to eventually write for Crisis, and I'm delighted to have an audience there. It's a remarkably a responsive audience, as you know,
yes,
as a writer and now the editor, that there are hundreds of comments on columns and thousands of social media shares. So it is a very lively audience, yes, very engaged audience.
Yeah, which is great, which is because you don't see that a lot of places. I know a lot of places are afraid to put comments on because it can get a little bit unwieldy to manage them, because you get the spam, you get the people who are disrespectful at times. But yeah, we try to have a somewhat open policy to allow real discussion and debate. Like, you know, we'll have people come in there who will be very pro-Trump and the people very anti-Trump, for example, which I like. I mean, I think it's good to have that. As long as people are respectful, they're not going against church teaching on things, you know, we can handle a little bit of debate.
And sometimes people are banned, but not often.
Yes, right. We do have to drop the ban hammer every once in a while, and that happens. But yeah, and honestly, your articles are often the most popular ones we have, because I really think you touch on things that people are thinking about. You're also not afraid to go there, which I think is good, because the key for a popular article is you do go there, but you do it in a way that still respects those you disagree with. You're not trying to just be controversial to be controversial. You're just not afraid to say certain things that will get you canceled everywhere else.
I wish that I was a better writer. I wish that I was a writer as good as, you know, somebody like, Michael Warren Davis.
Right,
is a remarkable writer. But, you know, Tony Esselin. But I write in a very direct way.
Right.
But you know, it's funny because even when you try to be like respectful and complimentary and then disagree, man, they still get you anyway.
Oh, they do.
It was like years ago, we were running a series of columns for a long time on what I call the new homophiles. You know, the group of quote faithful Catholics who were also self-identified as LGBT. And man, I ladled the praise on those guys, but still I was called a hater because I disagreed with them. And that's one of the sad things that we encounter these days, is that if you disagree with a group of people on a particular issue, your only motivation can be hatred or racism or homophobia, right, or whatever. It's like engaging, you know, those writers around Pathos and other places who go after conservative Catholic organizations. I have been roundly and consistently called an anti-Semite, because somewhere in the these writers have ancestors who were of the Jewish faith. So therefore my only motivation can be anti-Semitism. It's a sorry state of events that people cannot engage on the issues without name calling.
Yeah, and it's really lazy too, because it doesn't even try to address the points you're making or the criticisms. And like you said, no matter how respectful you come about it, how much you try to look at their point of view, you're just an anti-Semite, homophobic, racist hater. Right. And you know, there's no reason. You know,
it's a way to shut down debate and not have to engage. It's lazy and ultimately harmful for those people who choose not to make the arguments and choose instead to call names. So, alas, it is the world we live in.
Yeah, but I will say, it is difficult. I mean, I've seen your Twitter feed, and you are not beloved in certain quarters of the Twitter sphere. And that's difficult, but that kind of takes me to what I wanted to talk about first a little bit, which was your work at CFAM. And your work overall, like, you clearly get attacked a lot, and you clearly are around a lot of people who are very much opposed to you and what you do. How do you do it? How do you keep going each day? I mean, you've been doing this for a long time.
Well, and I guess we can circle back to what the heck is an NGO and special consultative status with the UN Economic and Social Council. Right. CFAM, we founded CFAM in the summer of 1997 at the request of the Holy See, that there be an office of full-time Catholic laymen working on UN social policy negotiations at the United Nations. You know, hundreds of people had gone to the Cairo conference in 1994 on population and development, and then hundreds more went to the Beijing Women's Conference in 1995, and it became very obvious two things: that having laymen involved was a great assist to not just the Holy See, but other conservative delegations who are trying to defend life, faith, and family from the onslaught of the radicals. And these types of fights happen more than in just these big global conferences. As a matter of fact, they happen pretty much every single day at UN headquarters in New York. So we answered that call in the summer of 1997. Special consultative status with the UN Economic and Social Council is what is known as, you know, the NGOs that apply for accreditation so that they have their own badges, they can participate in UN negotiations, they can get into the building, they can get into negotiations. It just makes you a part of, I don't want to say a family because it's not a family, but so the UN community. And the radicals tried for years to keep pro-life and pro-family NGOs out of the building, out of negotiations, away from special consultative status. But the doors finally opened, and many of us were able to. There are probably 20 pro-life and pro-family organizations that have consultative status. At this point, we're one of only a few who have full-time offices at the UN in New York, you know, a block from the UN. So the heart of our work is assisting UN delegations in negotiating documents to make sure that abortion does not become an internationally recognized human right, to ensure that the family is not redefined, to ensure that sexual orientation, gender identity don't become a new category of non-discrimination in international law. And quite frankly, we've been quite successful in all of those. This fight has now been going on since 1994, as I said, and there is no international right to abortion. There is no redefinition of the family. Sexual orientation and gender identity are not a part of international law. It just goes to show you that a small group of very determined people can have an outsized effect, even in the international debate. But that's my day job. And all these other things, you know, the columns for you guys and the books and the Twitter feed are all sort of extracurricular.
Yeah, it's amazing, because I remember the 1990s, the UN battles very well, because they're very public back then. I mean, JP2 was leading a lot of it, but I remember Cairo and some other cases. And my honest opinion at that time was that the UN was a lost cause, and within a few years, it would do everything you just said it hasn't done. It would redefine marriage, it would redefine family, it would make abortion a human right throughout the world. So, I mean, that is amazing that it hasn't fallen completely. I mean, I think most of us look at the UN with a healthy dose of suspicion, most faithful Catholics, because it usually works against us.
And well, you should.
Yeah. So give an example of maybe recently, like some type of victory there. Like, how do you keep the radicals from just making abortion a human right internationally? What's the process of making sure that doesn't happen?
It's simply finding, we're doing a negotiation right now. There's an annual commission called the Commission on the Status of Women. From January through the spring, there are a series of these commissions that write non-binding resolutions that are later accepted by the UN General Assembly in the fall. So right now we're negotiating a document on the Commission on the Status of Women. So what will happen is that into that document will be inserted language that will be used to promote a right to abortion. First of all, to understand that abortion cannot be established through a non-binding resolution. However, repeating it often enough in these non-binding resolutions is an argument that they make that something called customary international law has been established. This is false, but so rights and various permutations will be inserted into the draft document. We will work with, 10 to 20 delegations to negotiate that language out or to define it or to change it. And so right now in the Commission of the Status of Women, my guys up in New York are working very closely with various UN delegations in actual negotiations to do all that, to get it out, to change it, to redefine it. And like I said, we've been successful. That is not to say that the phrase reproductive health has not appeared in UN documents. It's appeared in many, many documents. But we have, there's a thing in customary international law called the persistent objector. And if there is a persistent objector, it works against the idea that customary international law has been established. And so I guess we have been the persistent objector with UN member states. We have been the sand in the gears that slow the machine or stop it. And they're very unhappy with us. They're very unhappy with the delegations that stand up, fight back, as they used to say in the AIDS days. That's what we do. We give new delegates the information about how the other side uses the trickery of language. We show them new ways of language. We try to give them courage and persistence. And for the most part, we've been successful. It's just like being there. Those who win are generally those who stay to the very end. And Father Newhouse said, and who write the minutes. We don't get to write the minutes, but for the most part, we've won and we will continue to win. That does not mean that the other side has given up, because they're right there at the Commission on the Status of Women trying it again, and then at the Commission on Population and Development and all the commissions, and next fall in the General Assembly. We are having right now the exact same debate that we had in 1994 at the Cairo Conference.
Right.
That's how crazy this is.
Yeah. I love that title, persistent objector. I think you should put that as like, that's your title. You're the persistent objector. I love it. I love it. Now, how does your work there change based upon since you're United States, you're based in the United States, change based upon the United States administration? Like, for example, is your work harder when Obama is president compared to Trump, compared to Biden and all that? Or is it basically you're considered like just a NGO, so you're not really country-based?
Well, yeah, we're not tied to any particular national group. I guess it's a little bit easier. I mean, it depends on who's in the administration. Of course, our lives are harder when both harder and easier when somebody like Obama or Biden come in. I'm by nature an outsider, so I enjoy being on the outside.
Okay.
And trying to change things. It was both harder and easier during the Trump administration. It was easier because the Trump administration, well and truly, was the most pro-life administration we've ever had. That's not to say that our job was easy, because there were an awful lot of people in the State Department who were absolutely against the wishes of the president. And so we had to work extremely hard over those 4 years to get the administration to do what they ultimately did, and that's draw a bright line around the phrase reproductive health and say, we will not accept this. So it has to be deleted. It has to be defined. or something new has to be inserted in its place. And we achieve something that is actually quite remarkable. We made reproductive health controversial again under the Bush administration. The Bush administration didn't even think about doing some of the things that the Trump administration did at the United Nations. The Bush administration accepted reproductive health in the first hard law treaty ever, the Treaty on Persons with Disabilities, which fundamentally changed the game, because before then it had only appeared in non-binding resolutions. So it depends upon who's there. And it makes our lives a little bit easier when it's somebody like Obama or Clinton or Biden, because then we can go full throttle. Right. It makes the overall debate harder because the United States has a lot of power. So it's a little bit like a Rubik's Cube. And that was how it was described to me by a Philippine diplomat back in 1997, that the United, he asked me if I wanted to meet with the Iranians. And I went, can I meet with the Iranians? Yeah. And he said, well, the UN is a Rubik's Cube. And you know, you agree with some people on Monday and you disagree with them on a Tuesday. And subsequently, we worked with the Iranians, and the Iranians throughout the years have been quite good on the question of abortion and family and things like that. Obviously, antagonistic to our country, but we have to put that aside for the central issue that we are working on, which is the defense of life, faith, and family in UN documents at the UN.
That was something I was going to ask you. I know there was a lot of hope back in the 90s that Catholics and Catholic nations, if there are any Catholic nations left, could work together with predominantly Muslim nations on these type of issues. And I think I'm very skeptical, frankly, of any type of working together with Muslims, because I feel like Catholics would give away everything and we don't really acknowledge our differences. But in this case, we're working for a shared goal, hopefully. Have you found it that the Muslim nations have in general been at least receptive to these pro-family, pro-life type of initiatives?
You know, I'll tell you a little anecdote. Years ago, I guess it was in the Washington Post, they asked me a similar question. And I used this phrase that the Muslims are our allies and not necessarily our friends. Okay. A Muslim diplomat got in touch with me and he was quite upset. He said, because I thought we were friends. So I was invited to give a talk at Brigham Young University for a meeting of Muslim diplomats. And the speech that I gave at that time, it was entitled, I'd Rather There Be Muslims in My Foxhole, in talking about all of these issues, that there is a common foe coming for all of us. And that is the sexual revolution and the sexual revolutionaries. I also told him in the context of that speech that God wanted all of them to become Catholic. And there were smiles all over the room because they admire strong,
yes,
brave faith.
Yes.
So they didn't have a problem with that at all. I like to say that I have more in common with a hard-nosed Calvinist than I do with a dissenting Catholic, because I can count on them, even if they think that I am not only wrong, but damnably wrong, because we can put all that aside and work on common projects. And I call this the true ecumenism, where, right, you don't shave off aspects of the faith. You might put them aside for a while and work on common issues. And what inevitably happens is that you eventually begin debating the faith, but it's done among friends and therefore it's, right, not done in anger. Yeah, I call that the true ecumenism, and I see conversions happening from this type of true ecumenism, where you don't shave off aspects of the truth, you're not embarrassed of the faith. So it's been a very interesting journey these 24 years, working in close proximity with Muslims and people of other faith. It was 5 years in I guess, 1999, maybe 2000. We led one of the exorcists of the Archdiocese of New York into one of these grand negotiating rooms. And it was before the building opened, and I knew the way in, and you know, and took him up in the balcony, and he read the prayers of exorcism and the blessings of a building of communications. And among us were Catholics, Mormons, and Muslims. And it was quite beautiful. So yeah, it's the true ecumenism. Yeah.
I remember back in the pro-life rescue days, Protestants and Catholics, we would sit in front of the abortion clinics together, get arrested, and then when in jail, we'd argue about theological topics. And that is the true ecumenism, because we work together.
Yeah, you know, it's arguments among friends.
Right. We know we have
one of my goals on Twitter is to have one of these knockdown, drag out fights and then start talking about music or television and sort of leave on a friendly note.
Right.
Because I think everybody actually wants to be friends.
Right. Yeah. I think we're finding less and less so people willing to even acknowledge kind of the humanity of our opponents. Just call by, you know, the name calling and all that, like we talked about.
You know, I remember one time I was in the comment boxes of a pretty vicious blog called Slowly Boiled Frog, run by a guy named David Hart, who I've subsequently become friends with, wrote a column about this for Crisis called Slowly Boiled Friendship. And I recall I was in the comment sections going tooth and nail with some guy. And I think it was about sodomy, to tell you the truth. And then all of a sudden he asked me a question about music. And we begin this very friendly conversation about, I prefer jazz, I prefer classical, and we're trading information, and we're talking about TV shows and things like that. And we left, I guess, as friends.
Right.
And I call that breaking the fourth wall. You know, this term from television, where you turn around and you talk directly to the audience. And in this case, you take away that wall that separates you, and you talk to someone as a human being. And I like that.
Yeah, and it's particularly difficult to do on the internet, because when you're in person with somebody, most people, maybe not sociopaths, but most people, they're going to try to get along with the person they're talking to. They might have a real serious disagreement, but they see them as a person. Whereas online, it's just an avatar and often not even a real name.
Yeah.
And so it's easier just to look at them as just the sum of their argument, which might be terrible, might be idiotic, but that's not all they are. I mean, like you said, they might love the same music you do. Maybe they have the same hobbies you do. They might, you know, they have kids probably that they love and take care of well. And so it's like seeing them as real, as images of God, as we're supposed to. And of course, the past year, when we've shut everything down, made it even harder to interact with people in person, I think has just increased the attacks that we have on each other, the reducing people to just their opinion on one issue.
You know, I reject the idea of trying to find common ground, because I think it's really hard to find common ground, but what you can find are common interests.
Right.
And this is why you might both be Cardinal fans. And you're going at a tooth and nail, and all of a sudden you're talking about the Cardinals, and there is a glimpse of humanity.
You might both hate the Cardinals, but go ahead. I'm a Reds fan,
you might both be fans of The Walking Dead, or
you're right,
or something. It's you are a human being, and so is the other person, rather than just duking it out on the internet. So I try to eventually look for common interests.
That's a good way to put it. I like that.
Common ground. Oh yes, we all believe that, you know, in peace and justice and all that. Okay, fine. And that ultimately is kind of meaningless. Really means something if somebody says, well, you know, did you see the fifth episode of the fourth season of The Crown?
Right.
That was amazing.
Yeah.
And it was, by the way.
Yeah.
So anyway, common interests, I think, are the way to go.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, because love can grow. You know, when you become friends, and you become friends through common interests, that's how you did.
Right.
Did it on the playground. And it began in a fist fight, and then you became friends.
Right.
It's just, hey.
Yeah. So it kind of takes me to the subject of your book, your next book, Under Siege, No Finer Time to Be a Faithful Catholic, is what it's called. Yes. I want to make sure I got the title exactly right. I know it changed at one point a little bit. So the title and the subtitle seem to contradict, mm-hmm. because being under siege does not seem like something that is a good thing. And so why is that all of a sudden a fine time to be Catholic when you're under siege? Your positive attitude here is kind of coming out, even though people know your work, you're in the midst of the battle. And so yet you're staying positive. And like the title of this book kind of suggests that. So what do you mean by that?
Lame us to defend his creation at a time of maximum desperation. That's what I mean by that. Our world is under siege. Our faith is under siege. The church is under siege. Culture is under siege. And who did he call? He called us. But look back at the apostles. They weren't exactly the A-team. I mean, they didn't go to whatever Harvard was back in the first century. And neither did most of us. My joke about all this is he called us because he called lame us because he wants all the credit, which is fine. That's what I mean by that, is that many people are nostalgic. I set up this idea that many people live in constructs that keep them away from the fight. For instance, many people live in fear. I use the example of Rod Dreher. There's a long section of the book about Rod Dreher. Some people live in nostalgia, where they dream of the 1950s, or they dream of the Middle Ages. Other people, many more people probably are in the third category, and that's they live in distraction. Video games, television, sports, whatever, that really take them away from the central issues of our time. And what they miss is this amazing opportunity that God has given us to defend his creation. I say in the book that there are halos hanging from the lowest branches of the trees, and all you have to do is reach up and grab one. All you have to do, the problems around us are so immense that all you have to do to make the world a better place is just a little bit of something. It's not like you have to fix the whole thing. Just make it a little bit better. So that's what that means. We are under siege, and we are so remarkably blessed that it's us that he sent, because he knew, he knows, and he knows us.
So here's the issue I think a lot of Catholics will have. Our own church, though, is against us often. I mean, church leaders will say that is probably more accurate to say. So how do we keep on going about fighting the battle when we know we're not going to get backing from the bishops, from the Vatican, from almost anybody in any type of leadership position? When one priest says one thing that's slightly good, all of a sudden he becomes a media superstar within the Catholic world. And I'm not denigrating any of those priests who do that. I'm just saying it's such a low bar because it's so uncommon. So how do we react to that? I mean, how do we deal with that?
Well, years ago I was giving a speech in Ireland. I was on a speaking tour called the Wake Up Ireland Tour. It was really remarkable. And after one of these speeches one night, this little old lady comes up and she goes, "Austin, what you're saying is all well and good, but I'm going to wait and hear what the bishop has to say." And I said, "No, you don't have to wait to hear from the bishop to do what God has given you to do." And for the most part, the bishop doesn't want you to ask him, "Can I go do this thing?" Just go do it. I remember I said this exact thing at a conference in Seattle, I think, and there was an American cardinal there, and he came up afterwards. I think it was he's passed now. I think it was Bevilacqua, might have been. Okay. Anyway, he shook my hand and he said, "Yes, too many laymen want my permission to carry out their biblical promises, But I mean, the world is ours. That's the way that God set things up. There's one pope and there's so many bishops and there's a couple of billion laymen. So our job is to stand with our backs to the church, facing the world and slaying the dragons. Sometimes it happens that we come into a lot of static from bishops or priests or whatever. It doesn't matter. I would also say, something a little bit controversial. It's not our job to change the church. It is our job to change the world. Mm. Now, some laymen are called to work on sort of intra-church issues, but really our job, and this is the way God set things up, is to fix the world. So yeah, we're going to be discouraged, and the bishops are going to disappoint us, and there's going to be priests like Father James Martin who are going to say heretical things. And you know what? None of that matters. None of that changes the fact that you need to go to the very next school board meeting and raise hell. You know, none of that changes the fact that you need to get involved. My next column for you, which I'm going to get to you later today or tomorrow morning, is called Andrew Breitbart Was Wrong. And I hate to say this in the octave of his death, the remembrance of his death. But when he said that culture is downstream, politics are downstream from culture, he's wrong. You know, there was not a great cultural call to get rid of prayer in school. It was created, 11 of 13 judges who heard that case stood up for school prayer. When it was struck down by the Supreme Court, every governor in the country objected except for one, the governor of New York. Newspapers coast to coast criticized the decision. This was a political decision that was imposed on the culture, and the culture followed. The same thing with the contraception decision. Certainly the same thing with the abortion decisions, and exponentially true with gay marriage and sodomy. You know, in Lawrence v. Texas, there wasn't a groundswell of support for legalizing sodomy. It was imposed through a political process. The same thing with Obergefell. So we can work on culture. Absolutely. And culture does affect politics, but that doesn't give us a pass from working on politics and working on political solutions, because the other side has no hesitation in imposing politics on a reluctant culture.
Yeah, I'm convinced one of the significant days of this century was May 9th, 2000, was it 11 or 12? Now I get the year wrong, when Obama officially came out for gay marriage. I remember how Biden kind of got it ready. Great Biden. But then Obama said, because I feel like it felt like to me the day before you could be against gay marriage and you're still a human being, because after all, Saint Obama was. But the day after, you were a bigot. I mean, you were the worst form of a Nazi, basically, in one day. And that was because one political leader made a statement, and it all of a sudden, and nobody wants to be a bigot. And so the vast majority of people, we're like, well, okay, I guess I'm for gay marriage now because I don't want to be a bigot. I don't want to be one of those people. And I think that radically changed. And of course, then it led to so much else, where now today, even a suggestion that gay marriage is not actually marriage will get you fired at many places, get you kicked off of social media, obviously, and lots of different things like that. And I think it's all because one political leader made one statement. I mean, he basically changed his position.
Well, and keep in mind the cultural context of those times. This was a time when the culture really had spoken for traditional marriage. Yes. And not for gay marriage. Traditional marriage had won 32 statewide elections, 32. The other side, I think, won two. So the culture, the ground was not prepared for gay marriage. The culture was not calling out for gay marriage. What they led with was politics. And you're right, Obama flip-flopping on. I mean, when he said he was against it, nobody believed him anyway.
Well, yeah.
But when he said that, of course.
But it gave cover to those who were opposed to it.
What's that?
It gave cover, though, to those who were opposed to gay marriage. Yeah, absolutely. Well, Obama's absolutely. Even, you know.
So, you know, I'm reading these articles about Carrie Beckman and her project outside of Tyler, Texas, to create a Catholic community there. One of the first jobs that I had writing in this work was for Roger McCaffrey and his magazine, Sursum and Corda. And he sent me around the country doing stories on precisely these types of things. There's a community in Arkansas called Star of the Sea Village, the community around Steubenville, the community around Front Royal, Virginia. So I know this whole idea. And one of the things that struck me, and I've got it right here, where in the National Catholic Register, Carrie said, right now we have a lot of people who want to fix politics, and that's noble, she goes on, but unfortunately that's way down the river. And what we need is these institutions to help get people to think right, and then they'll act right. And I say, God bless. I mean, I'm all for the good, the true, and the beautiful, and working on those issues. But an awful lot of us have to work on politics. We cannot cede that ground to the other side. And we can win. Just see what we have done at the United Nations.
Right. I guess, okay, so I know you mentioned Roger Ayer before. And I will admit that I have at times, not as much recently, been sympathetic to some of his arguments, the Benedict option, things like that, because just in the idea of, like, for example, me, I've worked from home. We homeschool our kids. We go to a traditional Latin mass. All these things are, in a sense, getting out of the culture in a Benedict option in small ways. And I feel like those are very good things to do. Yet you've been pretty consistently critical of his way of going about it. What's really kind of your issue with kind of Dreher's defeatism, I think you've called it before, and that problem?
Okay. Well, you know, I read about the Benedict option for years before he published the book. You know, he would, he works out his ideas in his columns. And in the very beginning, he really was saying we need to all move to and build a community around the walls of Clear Creek Abbey in Oklahoma.
Okay.
He really meant that. And that is the sort of the old sense of communities being built up literally around a monastic enclosure. So that was the beginning. He slowly backed off of that. But when I talk about Rod and fear, and I live kind of the Benedict option. I live in Northern Virginia. There are a couple hundred highly motivated, mission-oriented Catholic families around here. Our daughters go to Oak Crest, which is the Opus Dei middle school, high school. They went to grade school at our local church, which is Montessori school. Any home that they go into is going to be just like ours. So we sort of live that. I mean, the idea of a Benedict option was not new for Rod. It was not new for the world. People have always done this kind of thing. But my objection to Rod, and I read deeply in his columns over the years, he always thinks that the world is about to end. You know, I actually at the time did not follow him on peak oil. Heck, I didn't even know what peak oil was. Do you know what, did you follow peak oil when it was happening?
I remember hearing about it and stuff. Wasn't it like all of a sudden, like we're going to use up all the oil or something? Or
yeah, we were going to run out of oil and we were going to be living in the Stone Age. And Rod absolutely 100% believed that we were months away from subsistence farming. And then he got deeply into Y2K and that the world was going to end at Y2K. And then the soft totalitarianism because of the left and the pandemic. Wow, the pandemic. I mean, he absolutely was convinced that the pandemic was going to sweep the world. He wrote about a dream that Frederica Matthews Green had, that this virus was floating in and it was going to kill 30% of the world's population. So he's like one of those guys with a sandwich board, the end of the world is nigh. That's kind of my problem with Rod. Okay. is he truly does live in fear. Now, he objected to that when I wrote a column about it at Crisis. He said that I don't know his personal life. I mean, we used to be friends in New York years ago, but you know, and that he's really a happy, joyful person. Fine. But he also lives in fear. He left New York out of fear. He left the Catholic Church out of fear for his children. And he says he stopped believing in the claims of the Catholic Church, but a large part of it was the pre-sex scandal and his fear for his children. And I think that he instills this kind of fear in his readers. And I think it can get people in a frame of mind that they do not really want to engage the culture. Now, I deliberately did not read Live Not by Lies because I was afraid that there was going to be some overlap between that and the book that is coming out in April, Under Siege. And I deliberately did not read it. But I understand that in there are strategies for coping and fighting back and things like that. And so now that my book is to bed, I'll probably read it. But my chapter on all these distractions is actually Live Not in Fear.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, so let's, I want to get a little bit practical then. Like, I think both of us have seen, I mean, Rod's actually an example of this, of people we know who are Catholic, they're in the battle, and then they end up losing their faith. You know, he lost his faith in Catholicism, but he's not the only one. And because sometimes when you get in the battle, you wrote about this for Crisis just last week, too long in the culture wars, that you see things and you hear things that humanity, we're not supposed to be see and hear. I mean, it does not bring us closer to God to see and hear these things. But the fact is that because they're out there, we have to fight them. How do you balance between, you know, fighting and actually, I mean, especially when it comes to the homosexual movement, some of the stuff is just so, you know, our friend Joseph Scambra, I mean, he's a, you know, he has been in it. It just, it's so terrible. You don't even want to think about it. Yet when you, and you know, that's kind of overtaken a lot of the bishops and priests and stuff. What do you do to not just lose your faith and keep on keeping on?
You know, it's almost a matter of temperament. I mentioned in my book, a column that Steve Skocic wrote about, you know, he says, I've been at this fight for the church for 20 years and nothing's changed. And it was practically, and naturally it was picked up and praised by Rod Dreher, but it was a cry of the heart about why he had not won yet. And it made me worry for him.
Right.
I worry all the time about Joe Shambra. You know, when yes. you read his social media, it is despairing. And I worry that he's going to leave the church because he can't find any support among bishops or priests. I love the guy.
Yeah, and which is going to be on the heads of those bishops and priests when they die. And I don't want to be in their place because the way they've treated
them. I'm sorry, I can't hear
you. I was just saying that what they, the way the bishops and priests have treated men like Joseph Scambra is just, it's so.
No, very few have even met with him. I set him up with Cardinal Burke, and Cardinal Burke told me the most charming story about that meeting with Joe, Joe was so nervous in meeting with him. When they sat down, he says, I've got notes on what I want to say to you, and I would prefer to read them. And so he went through all of these notes about the things that he wanted to say. But God bless Burke for meeting with him. You know, I don't know that Joe will leave the faith, but he very well might leave the church for Eastern Orthodoxy, which he views as perhaps stronger on this issue, but I don't even think that's true.
Right.
But here's the answer to your question. It is an aspect of temperament. You know, I'm by nature a happy warrior, and I don't want to say that I don't care if we win or lose. But for me, the joy is in the fighting, is in you know, doing the work. You know, as Mother Teresa said, we were not called to be successful; we're called to be faithful. Tolkien used the phrase "the long defeat." Joseph Pierce has a really wonderful essay or two that I cite in the book about this idea of the long defeat. That we're, you know, our reward is not here; it's someplace else, and we need to stop focusing on the idea that we have to win. What we have to do is try, and with joy in our heart, you know, it's funny because a lot of people, and this is because of social media, think that I'm angry, and I'm not. I mean, you know, I am motivated by anger at the radical feminists trying to impose their view on the world, but not in any real sense.
Right.
You know, but yeah, you know, it's a very difficult question for a lot of people that I fight and fight and fight and nothing changes. And what am I supposed to do? So yeah, it's tough.
I admit I'm inspired just listening to you right now, because I admit I will sometimes, my temperament isn't quite, it's not on either end of the year spectrum or the other end, but I there are days where I'm just like, what's the point of this? Why even bother, you know, engaging in it? But like you said, it's not about winning, because ultimately the victory is the Lord's and he's going to win, but it's just going to maybe not be in our lifetime or...
You know, a big part of the book, and I think a unique part of the book, and this has been a part of a speech that the book came out of a speech that I've been giving for years called No Finer Time to Be a Faithful Catholic. And a major part of that speech and the book is that we are living through one of the most remarkable epochs that the church has ever known, and that people cannot miss it through fear or distraction or anything like that. In the early church, they had to duke it out over who is Jesus. The later church had to duke it out over what is the church. We have been given this amazing debate to participate in, what is the human person? This is a debate for the ages that we get to participate in. But narrowing it down just a little bit, there have been events, and I'm not going to tell you what they are because I want people to buy the book, starting in 2002 with the Long Lent and going up to the present day, certain things have happened in the church that demonstrate that the world is obsessed with us. The world cannot get enough of us. And certain events have happened politically in the United States and culturally in the United States, one after another, that when you look at them all together, you realize we're living through a remarkable epic. If you just remember them, oh yeah, I remember that, string them all together and you'll see we're living in a profound time and people cannot miss it through fear or distraction or nostalgia.
That's great. So let's wrap it up here, but I want to make sure everybody knows Under Siege, No Finer Time to Be a Faithful Catholic by Austin Roos, coming out April. Do you have an exact date?
It's coming out April 27th. And let's remind people it's coming out from Crisis Publications.
Crisis Publications, exactly. So very proud of that fact. So make sure I think you can pre-order it on Amazon already, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, of course, Amazon is evil. So you
can
try
it. Yeah, people can pre-order it now. And I really wish that they would. And when they buy it, I want them to go to Amazon and write a review.
Yes.
It's a great honor to work with the good people at Sophia Institute Press, you know, Charlie McKinney and Tom Allen and all the editorial staff who were very careful. It was a really good experience, and I'm happy to be in cahoots with you guys, both at the book level and the column level.
Yeah, and we're happy to have
you. I mentioned you in the book, though. I don't think it survived the editing process.
Oh, I got cut. Oh, my goodness. I'm on the cutting room floor. They're probably like, no, get that guy out of there. We don't want too much association.
I know.
With him, so that's okay. Well, thank you anyway. Okay, anything else? Where can people best find like your work? Obviously, Crisis. You write for us. Like every
people
2 weeks.
People can find all of my columns at crisismagazine.org. And they can find all about CFAM at C-FAM, like family, c-fam.org. We have a very robust site. We have a weekly report called the Friday Facts, which is originally reported news coming out of UN headquarters in New York and also Washington, D.C. We do two stories a week and have been doing it. We haven't missed a week. We've missed 1 week in 24 years, and that was during 9/11. And my guys have been here for years. You know, most of my guys have been here 8, 9, 10 years, and they know this stuff as well as anybody in the world. They're highly competent and credentialed. I'm sitting next to Rebecca Owis, who came to us. She was a bench scientist in molecular biology at Emory University, has been with us for, I think, 9 years. Stefano Generini, who has a law degree from Notre Dame, has been with us for 8 or 9 years. And he is the guy that delegations go to for assistance in negotiations. It's a remarkable team who knows this stuff as well as any group in the entire world.
That's awesome. So at c-fam.org for Austin's great work, and also in crisismagazine.com, you can see his articles plus all the other stuff we're doing. Okay, well, that's it for this episode. Again, be sure to subscribe to the Crisis Point, where we just started back up. We had Scott Hahn 2 weeks ago, Jan Smith last week. We have Austin today. I think we got Monica Miller talking about a lot of the pro-life work she does next week. So a lot of good stuff happening here. Okay, so till next time. See you later.